Don't make it feel like I'm putting the gloves on to have a fight with James Cameron, because, you know, he's probably going to win. My point of view is slightly different. But I also understand his point of view. But I'll meet you on the top oval, James. Let's do it. You know, I'm not trying to start a fight. I'm a lover, not a fighter.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Envelope. Kelvin Washington, Ivan Villarreal, Mark Olson, and it's great to have you both here as usual, and especially when this is our last episode before Oscar nomination. So I'll start with you, Ivan. Maybe it could be anything. It could be a movie, a director, some rising star, or just anything that you hope once they read those nominations that morning you're going to hear.
I'm not going to say The Usual Suspects because that's covered. I really want to see Chase Infinity get nominated for her role in One Battle After Another. I just think she's been such a revelation for me as somebody who watched Presumed Innocent, seeing her in this role. And I don't want to spoil anything, but, you know, she really finds herself in a hairy situation in this film, and the way she sort of rises to the occasion and really has a moment of triumph for herself, I think it was just striking to watch. And she'll be in the Handmaid's Tale spinoff, The Testaments. I'm really looking forward to see what she does there. But also I'll say, as somebody who got thrown into the bandwagon of K-pop Demon Hunters because of my six-year-old niece, I want to see that get some love in the animated category. So,
and in the music category, the music song.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It better. Do you know how much I have to hear that song in my household with three daughters, 9, 7, and 4? Like, I'm going to be golden.
Are they memorized?
That's an understatement. Okay. I didn't even know. It's to the point, like, I'm concerned. Is it like some robotic AI that's taking over my daughter's brain?
Right.
Instantly. That instantly. In 6, 7.
Yeah, of course. Sorry.
I have to deal with that every day. All right, sorry. Mark, swinging at you. What do you got?
The actress Rose Byrne for the movie If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. She won a lot of critics' prizes kind of leading up to the nominations. And I think it would be so exciting if the filmmaker on that, Mary Bronstein, also got recognized either for the screenplay or as director. You know, Mary's someone that she made her first film, Yeast, more than 15 years ago and had not gotten a second project going, had sort of been living a life and doing other things. And to see her sort of reemerge with this project in particular, which is so powerful and so specific, that it would be really exciting that as great as it is to see Rose being rightfully recognized, it'd be really nice as well to see Mary get some attention as well.
So I'm going to jump in a couple. One, because she's been on the radar for years as just a multitude of things. She's multifaceted. Tiana Taylor can dance. She can sing. She can. You know, she's just all of that. And now acting alongside Leonardo DiCaprio. I mean, very, very impressive for her. And not a debut, but kind of a maybe for those who aren't familiar. So I'd be interested to see. I have a feeling we're going to hear her name. And then I'm going super popcorn, Raisinets.
Thank you.
Junior Mints, meaning going to the theater. Formula One for me. I know it was kind of...
Whoa, that's a throwback.
I know. But hear me out. It was fun. It was just fun. And it kind of one of those movies like, you know, you forget that you go to the movies. It's going to be a little fun, maybe a little cheesy. But dang it, I'm here. I've got my popcorn, all of that. So, you know, that for me was another one that was like, oh, man, like that's kind of the movie-going experience sometimes we've forgotten about.
And it's always good to see the Oscars recognize a film like that as well. I mean, it helps just for attracting audience to the telecast. But I think it is important that, you know, the Oscars recognize a breadth of filmmaking styles, and that one of the things that's so exciting about the movies is that it can be so many different things, from like a really small, you know, personal story to some big, you know, high tech, you know, film like F1, the movie. And so I think, yeah, to see that recognized in some of the major categories would be really exciting.
You know why I like Mark? Because he tried to legitimize my choice.
I didn't.
And I'm okay with
There's
that.
There's no try.
Because I know.
You don't need
look,
to
I'm going
to
look in the camera. You know why? Because I know someone's going to be, they're going to be highbrowing me right now. And I get it. And I'm with you. However, as we know, we can get all in types of mergers and some things have happened. Are people going to be going to movies anymore? And I was sitting in it going, oh, yeah, this is kind of what that feels like as well. So, ha, okay, take that.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
My reaction was more, it had been a while since I heard the title.
That
because,
felt the same.
Yeah.
It felt the same.
Sorry.
Well, whatever. I like what I like, okay? I enjoyed it. That's all I have to say about that. All right. Mark, coming to you now. We're talking about buzz, Oscar buzz, but just buzz and a lot of attraction that someone can get from a role. Talk about Joel Edgerton playing a logger in Netflix's Train Dreams. What was that conversation like?
It was a really terrific conversation, actually, that, you know, so this is a movie. It premiered at Sundance last year and was picked up by Netflix there. And even though it has that machinery behind it, there is still something that feels very organic about the success of this movie, that it genuinely feels like it's word of mouth that people have been discovering the film. And it has just a really quiet power to it. And a lot of that comes from Joel's performance, that, you know, he was originally pursued the rights to this book himself and wasn't able to get it. The rights were already taken. And so he sort of like thought, oh, well, that's that. And then years go by and the project comes back around and, you know, he's offered this role that he'd been so interested in playing. And he feels like it's hit him at a very specific time in his life. The part is he set in the early part of the 20th century. He plays a logger in the Pacific Northwest, and it really is just a portrait of a life. And the story deals with grief and family. And Joel, in the subsequent years, has become a father himself. And he said how it just, like, you know, if he'd have played this a few years ago, he thinks it'd be totally different than the way it is him playing it now. And it was just, and also he just is a guy who's been in the business for a few years now. He has, I think, some really sharp opinions. Views on like what this business is, what the industry is like, you know, right now and where it's going. So it was a really terrific conversation to have with them.
It sounds like it. So let's get straight to it. Here is Mark and Joel right now.
Welcome to The Envelope. I'm Mark Olson, and I'm here today with Joel Edgerton, star of the movie Train Dreams. Joel, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
And now as we're talking, you know, the movie has been really building this sense of momentum around it with its reviews and awards. And while there is, you know, an awards campaign around the movie, there is something about it that feels very organic. Like, this movie seems to be catching on through word of mouth, just people seeing it and responding to it. How do you feel about the response to the movie?
Oh, look, it feels very good. I mean, you know, coming from a independent film background, I love it when small movies sort of make a lot of noise. And I think I can't really sort of analyze or diagnose why, but I get this feeling with Train Dreams that it means different things for different people. Mm. And it holds up a bit of a mirror to their own experience, being that the film is really the celebration of an ordinary life and shows the majesty in that. But it has a lot of, I mean, it's just got, what my character goes through. So they're universal experiences. And so people find something of their own experience in it. And I think that's part of the reason why. But it's a small movie, but it's also a very big movie.
And now maybe the other side of that, in a way, you were recently on a red carpet and you were asked about some comments that James Cameron had made regarding movies on streaming services and the awards race.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you want to say anything more about that, but also, do you feel like, in a way, that do people somehow hold it against Train Dreams that it's on Netflix?
Look, the world we live in now is so in the hands of the audiences because of social media. I feel like in the old days, well before I was born, we were told who our movie stars were. The studios would make those decisions for us, and things were very narrow. And now, you know, people have the power to choose what they want to watch, who they want to watch. They choose the movie stars. They speak about the movies. And Letterboxd, for example, is such a big thing. Mm. And in that same vein, it's really interesting to hear what people, regular people, moviegoers, think of how movies should be exhibited, how they feel, regardless of whether they know about the business side of things or not, or why things are the way they are. They have feelings, very sometimes very passionate points of view on where and how we should watch movies. And of course, for all of the business side, if we put it aside, I do believe people want to go to the cinema and watch movies. My comments sort of come from understanding now where I am in my life. You know, I'm all about creativity and all about story, but I do understand business. And I feel like I emerged out of my bubble in Sydney and felt like the whole world of cinema had suddenly changed. My views on streaming had started to evolve just after that when we released a movie at when we showed a movie at Cannes called The Stranger, another very small movie we made down in Adelaide. And Netflix picked up the movie, and I remember thinking, like, should we go with them, or should we? There were a few people curious about the movie on a business side. So many people saw that movie because it was on a streamer. And so my feelings are very mixed, and they're very much tailored to what the movie is, and therefore, according to what the movie is and how big or small it is, where it should live. I'm all for, like, pushing to fight for keeping cinema alive, and I believe a younger generation feels the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel like there are chances that some people have that are narrow as they get their start in the business, which means sometimes the first things you can do, you're not necessarily going to get a 2,000 screen release on your very first movie. So I have many, many opinions about it. But yeah, I feel like we all need to, we need to fight for cinema. We also sort of hopefully don't allow streaming, as great as it can be, to take over everything. Mm. That's my feeling.
And what is it like for you? I mean, the fact that you're also a producer as well, what is it? I mean, this feels like a moment of tremendous change. Like we're in the middle of something transformative happening to the industry. What is it like for you as a person sort of in the middle of that tide, just trying to navigate that for yourself?
Again, it's all about what is the story and where should it live. My feeling always, you know, is that if I ever get behind making something, I want as many people as possible to see it. I also want to have an exchange at the cinema. Well, one of the great things about Train Dreams is, you know, I've done about 50 Q&As so far. I haven't, like, counted them up, but around that. And we'll do a bunch more. We've been to a number of festivals, and we have an exchange with the audience. We get to watch and see people's reaction to the film in, like, analog way. You know, sometimes the feeling with letting a movie go on streamer without any fanfare is that it feels like it disappears into with a whisper, and you don't get to have that exchange. And I think that's very important. Every time I think about story, I'm thinking about how do we get as many people as possible to see it?
Yeah.
And my dream would be to make a film, exhibit it at the cinema, knowing that at some point it will end up on TV screens in people's lounge rooms all over the world.
Yeah.
And finding the right way to get a balance of both.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's nothing better than sitting in the cinema and watching a movie with a bunch of other people. The sad thing at the moment, it seems, and, you know, again, I don't know the full diagnostics of it, but, you know, you get a cinema release and you're there for like 2 weeks and then you're replaced by something else.
Yeah.
I'm old enough to remember the days where a movie would sit in the cinema for 6, 7, 8 weeks if it was good, you know?
Yeah. And now, I don't want to belabor the point, but I'm so curious about this. I'm assuming when you went to the Gotham Awards, you were not thinking, like, I'm going to give James Cameron a piece of my mind tonight. Like, do you find it in the time that, like, you've been doing this, have you found that, like, you may show up to something and you have no idea what someone's going to ask you, or, like, you kind of, almost like a political campaign, you kind of have to be ready to, like, talk about just about anything.
You're right. And I never expected a red carpet is a minefield. I do go home sometimes and think, what did I say? I knew what I said. And I also stand by what I said. What I don't love is the ease with which things, the process of reduction of someone's comments. Someone had sent me this thing that said that I lashed out, or that I used a word that was quite a violent one. Like I was sort of, you know, lashing back at James Cameron. I was like, no, I wasn't doing that at all. I actually had a fair and balanced opinion about the fact that James is excuse the semi-pun, a titan. He is a pioneer and an inventor, and we've seen that. He's created technology that has made movies better. He can exhibit movies in this broad scale because he's dared to dream big. And I feel like there's a world where there are people who are never going to get their first film on 2,000 screens because it's a small story. Movies like Sorry Baby, they're not 2,000 screen release movies. There's a world where they live somewhere, whether it's in small art house cinemas or whatever. So, you know, I was like, all right, don't make it feel like I'm putting the gloves on to have a fight with James Cameron, because, you know, he's probably going to win if that's the case. And that's certainly not what I was doing at all.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, my point of view is slightly different. But I also understand his point of view. But I'll meet you on the top oval, James. Let's do it. You know, I'm not trying to start a fight. I'm a lover, not a fighter.
And then to start talking about Train Dreams, you've talked a lot about how you read the book around like 2018 or so, and the rights weren't available, so you sort of, you know, set that idea aside.
Sulked a bit.
Well, what did you what do you feel like you were responding to then in that book?
Well, you know, I've heard the term neo-Western, which, you know, I understand now. It didn't really make sense to me at the time. When I first read the book, you know, we come into the story with this sort of violent act towards a Chinese worker, for anyone who's seen the film. And I thought, all right, this is... I didn't know Dennis Johnson's work at all at the time. The book had been gifted to me as a rap gift on Boy Erased. And I thought, if someone gives you a book, it means they think there's some meaning in it for you, that it will resonate with you, and it did. But I thought, oh, this is a Western. And then within a handful of pages, I realised it was a different kind of Western. Yes, it was set and looked, it would look and feel like a Western. But it was a rumination on a life itself. Not that it was going to answer the big elusive question of the meaning of life, but swirling questions of what is the purpose of a life, and what is the extraordinary details of a life we may never care to remember because the person is not the great inventor, the great general, the great president or superhero. I love the ordinariness. I loved the idea that it resonated with something that my parents had always instilled in me, which is that every single human being has a great story to tell and that we all shouldn't be considered insignificant. And I just was so moved by these sort of glimpses of one man's entire life. Wanted to get my hands on it, couldn't, and I'm happy to say that it's good that I didn't get my big fat lumberjack hands on it then, mostly because I think Clint is a remarkably sensitive, excellent filmmaker who has done a much better job than I ever would if I was in control of things. And because in the 4 years since he reached out to me to be in the film, I'd become a dad, and that was like everything to me. And if you've seen the film and you know what's inside of the film, I really believe that my performance... I don't know what my performance would have been like pre-Joel the dad, but now that I am a dad, it's like there's stuff inside of me that makes this performance possible.
But when it came back to you, do you feel like you responded to it in a totally different way? Like, did you recognize that difference right away?
100%. And I know it, there was a significant moment. So Clint came to meet me in Chicago, I was shooting Dark Matter. And I was very excited that this had somehow come around to me, knowing that I loved the book and the character so much. Then I watched Jockey and knew that he was a really, you know, solid filmmaker. His adaptation was extraordinary. And then when I met him, I realized as a filmmaker, he was like a director version of the central character of the film. Mm. Kind, honest, generous, you know, like a really great observer. And I went home and I spoke to my wife, and she obviously, her two big questions every time I want to do a project and she knows I want to do something is when and where. Because it means moving us around, you know, it's like, uprooting the family. Mm-hmm. She said, when and where? I told her, and Spokane didn't exactly make her click her heels because her life is about being plugged into big cities. She said, what's the story about? And I started trying to tell her the story. And when I got to the stuff that happens to Robert in the middle of the film and my 1.5-year-old twins are in the other room, I couldn't even finish telling her the story. And I realized then how much the story now kind of terrified me, but also was so much more connected for me. And she watched me kind of like, well, my chin was quivering. And she was like, all right, I guess we're going to Spokane.
And now, have you done a project that felt this personal before? Like, do you feel, and did that in its own way have any kind of anxiety attack? Like, did you have any reluctance to do this for the reason that you were connecting to it so strongly?
Yeah, I learned, you know, I feel like I learn something about myself on every job, and every time I approach a new job, I feel like, I always describe it like, you know, in rudimentary terms, like a toolkit. You go, what aspects of myself do I bring to this? Which parts do I leave behind? And how would I approach this? Like, for example, Gatsby, for me, I felt like, all right, this is about me tuning myself up to 11 out of 10. You know, like bringing something bigger. And with Train Dreams, what I really kind of learned was how much in the past I've tried to hide from myself, that I feel like, and I know a lot of actors think this, and I feel like it's a trap a lot of actors fall into, is thinking they're not enough and you have to adorn a performance to be really seen or heard or impress. And I realised how much I've avoided playing characters that are very much like me. Mm-hmm. And though Robert's a lumberjack, and I'm putting all the kind of trappings of it aside, on an emotional level, how much is a character like you? And I'm constantly trying to play dress-ups and, you know, I'm really interested in being people that I'm not. And I think that my favourite actors have often been transformative character actors. So I felt like my task in my mind was always to do something different and run away from the idea of just showing my own self, really. And I realized that as a husband, as a father, and as a guy who's constantly guilty and struggling with the idea of being away from my family for work, these are all things that Robert is just doing a different job, you know, a contract worker, which I am too, except, you know, I'm not chopping down trees. And I have my greatest fears around my kids and the safety of my kids. So it felt to me like this was a chance to be very open about my own feelings and bring that to the work without feeling like I had to put too much garnish on things. And that's a bit scary for me, but it now makes me realise it's probably a better path in the future to do a bit more of that, just be a bit more kind of open rather than hiding who I am, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, completely. Because a lot of reviews of the movie, I mean, I sort of said this myself, have noted how it feels almost as if like your career has been building to this performance, been leading to it somehow. And I'm wondering, does it feel like that to you?
I feel like I know that in decades to come, I'll look back and say always that Train Dreams is one of the great experiences I've ever had. The process and the result. I think the movie's fantastic, but what I got out of it myself personally, it was extraordinary. Look, I hope that I'm building towards something else extraordinary in the future, and each thing is, like I say, it's like a new mission with each film and each story and each character, but this one definitely feels special for me. And it feels like I use the word suitable, which feels so boring, but I've played characters that are not suitable for me in the past. And I've really challenged myself to bend into shapes that are, like I said, different from who I am, and rhythms that are different from what I'm like. Successfully or relatively unsuccessfully, I can't really judge it for myself. but this felt really suitable. It felt like it belonged to me. Yeah, it felt like it belonged to me.
Hmm. And now you're also, you know, a director, writer, producer. What is it like for you when you show up to a project and you're just an actor? Like, does that, is it hard for you, is it allow you to focus more on your performance? Or are you always like, you know, I was thinking you could put the camera.
It's such a relief. It's so excellent. I think directing is the best job in the world, but I wouldn't want to be doing it every time I went to work because there's a lot of stress, a lot of responsibility. Many times I've described the difference between acting and directing, you know, that an actor is like a child. Literally, you could turn up to work in your pajamas. Somebody would put makeup on you, dress you. You have one, well, I don't want to be reductive about it, but you have one job, to play your character and fit into the story, serve the story. And so you're a child, and as a director, you're running the household. You've got to do everything. You've got to stock the fridge. You've got to, like, make all the decisions about everything in the household. And there's so much responsibility to that. So I think directing is the most sort of dignified, excellent job. I was curious after I directed my first film how I would be walking onto another director's set. And it would be a sin. It would just be a sin to walk onto someone else's set and start to look over their shoulder and check their homework and sort of impose yourself on that process. I realized the two things that fascinated me the most were what lens was being put on the camera according to what the shot was. So I just became like really quietly observant. Actors who direct get this sort of great luxury of visiting so many sets and watching other directors and learning from them, you know, good and bad things, and behavioral stuff. It's not just about how their craft works or how they, you know, apply themselves as filmmakers, but how they conduct themselves as people, how they treat their crew, how they elicit the best out of their heads of department and give them freedom or not. Like Clint, for example, on Train Dreams, he's amazing at deputizing his heads of department, giving them freedom. And I think that's the greatest show of power as a director, the confidence of relinquishing control because you've hired the great people and you're trusting them to collaborate with you. So as an actor, I love just the freedom of just being there to serve the story. And then I'm like watching and putting little things in my kind of ideas bag for next time if I'm lucky enough to be the director again.
And you were recently on the Seth Meyers show, and he like said that he thought it was a very wonderful performance, and he noted how you don't have very much dialogue in the movie, and you said you think it's wonderful because you don't have much, there isn't much dialogue, and you were kind of kidding, but I wonder if you could unravel that a little bit. Like, how do you think how did the lack of dialogue in the movie sort of impact your performance?
Well, there's, you know, words are there to confuse us in the world, I think. You know, there's the things we say, what they actually mean. There's so many layers to any conversation you have with any person. There's something really interesting about people who don't speak very much. There's a mystery often to them. I think there's a lot of mystery to men that I grew up with in my life. This sort of curiosity. I find myself drawn to people that don't speak very much because I'm like wondering what they think. What do they think of me? What's going on in their mind? As an actor, I think approaching a role, and I guess I really cut my teeth on it with Loving, with Jeff Nichols, is a character, again, a very good man who had a lot of feelings and a lot to say, but for whatever reason or for certain different reasons with Richard Loving and with Robert, chooses not to say things or doesn't know if he has the right to say certain things. As an actor, I think what becomes the focus is knowing that the camera sees is looking into your soul, I guess, is that if the imperative to put the thoughts in the right place, to just be present, knowing that the camera will read those things. And of course, the story's job is to help guide us along, and we have a narration. But we're hoping, well, I was always hoping that the camera will see what's on my mind. And for me to then fill that with words would actually kind of be counter to what the character is, which is one of these very stoic, non-verbal men that I think we can all, that we can identify with, or that we've met in our lives. So it's just like putting the right thoughts in my head.
Because it is remarkable how often in the movie, it's as if we're just sort of watching you feel, that you're sort of taking in your surroundings, you're not really saying much, but it does, I mean, I will say, it does feel like we're in your head, that we can understand what the character is thinking and what you're conveying as a performer.
Thank you. I was smiling because I was remembering the square root of 8. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
It was an episode of Friends where I think it's Joey. Is it Joey? Who's the actor?
It's like
when you've got to act and you've got to look like you're really trying to work something out, he said, you've just got to think of the square root of 8. And it actually works. But I wasn't using it in Train Dreams.
But then the story does build to this scene with Kerry Condon where your character actually does explain himself. Like he sort of like talks about where he's coming from. What was it like to then sort of like flip the switch and have to be verbal and emotional in a more maybe conventional way?
Talking about emotion was one of the tricky things with Train Dreams. You know, Clint and I had many kind of, you know, conversations, very cerebral conversations, theoretical conversations about story. But emotion was one of them. It's like Robert's a character who doesn't really, one of these men who's not really willing to show his emotions, and when he does, he's very quick to put them down, or in the case of the film, he apologizes for showing his grief. But it's all building to this moment where he, and this is one of the things I love about the film, is that it illuminates the importance of human connection, that Robert meets his character Claire, that the audience feels like maybe there's a romance about to happen, which I love that it doesn't steer in that direction. These chance encounters with strangers that we maybe don't know that we need to have met on our journey, that are a chance for us to express ourselves, and they have a common experience of grief, and he has a chance to, whether he knows it or not, he's going to tell her about, I guess, his feelings of strange complicity in something he had no responsibility for. And we knew that we were building towards this, and yet at the same time, we're still trying to keep a lid on the emotions. But finally, Robert gets to speak, and it makes so much more sense of his silence up until that point if we finally hear him string more than a sentence together to try and talk about what's inside of him. And those scenes, we shot them in a short 1.5 hour window of Magic Hour with Kerry, who's just extraordinary. And it felt like time was standing still, even though we were, you would think that there would be a sense that we were rushing, and it felt like we had hours.
And the movie, part of what I know I responded to with it is that there's something so simple about it, but it also then feels so vast. And I'm just curious, as you're making the movie, are you talking with Clint or William H. Macy or Felicity Jones? Like, are you having these kind of big picture, like thematic conversations? Because the movie like invites these questions of like, what makes a life? Like, how do you define being a man? Like, are you having those conversations like while you're making the movie?
There's something fascinating about Train Dreams that it's something so that I say is so special about Clint is, I know this because I read so many screenplays and I think about story all the time, is this draw to tell an audience what to feel all the time, you know, whether it's through words, the story itself, music. Train Dreams does this thing that I as much as I can speak about it objectively, it's the same in the novella. These moments that aren't telling you what to feel. They're just layering on top of each other. And I feel like the sum total of the compression of all these things pulls something out of people in their own way. They find their own experience out of it, which can be quite emotional and quite cathartic in a good way. Particularly anyone who's been through moments where they've been knocked down in life. I think there's some sort of hopefulness in watching Robert's story. Mm. It's hard to define, but there's a confidence in the way Clint's rendered it. He's not telling you each time what to feel. Robert's not telling you, he's not screaming to the heavens. There's nothing sort of overly melodramatic or cathartic about it. And yet, these, I keep saying these layers build and compress. I had a very similar experience, I thought, watching Into the Wild, Sean Penn's film. It's another character isolating himself in nature. The credits rolled and something in me just was like, it was like I needed to feel something. I call them like a happy cry movie. You know, it's like you're crying, but you're like, I'm also happy at the same time. I'm confused.
There's a moment in the film that I find so haunting, and I've been trying to like unravel it for myself. The narrator, Will Patton, it's late in the film, so it's like the 1960s. You're portraying the character as an old man. Mm. And in the voiceover, he says he never spoke on a telephone.
Yeah.
And like, there's something about that I just find deeply moving and really haunting, and like I'm struggling to like even define for myself like what it is about that idea that like really gets me.
I guess there's these great things in the movie, and you know, that are, I call them like little sidecars or whatever, this idea that the world is sort of moving so quickly it's going to leave us behind. I mean, you know, it reminded me of my grandmother, who, when I pointed a video camera at her for the first time, she didn't move because she was thinking I was taking a photo of her, and I was saying, it's okay, this is a camera that's going to capture you moving. And she just stood there like I was photographing her. And she was like Robert. She never saw some of these things. She never experienced a lot of things. I think she went on an aeroplane once, in her, like a jumbo jet once in her life. And, you know, there's a great thing in the book, actually, that and it was talked about Robert and his point of view on the world and as he's aging. And it talks about his body, and his spine and the way his shoulders moved. And so a lot of the times when we're thinking about, for example, that scene where Robert goes up to the window and realizes he's staring at a man walking on the moon, you know, and he's looking up at the sky wondering, how is that even possible? That there's this sense of his physical dilapidation as he sort of moves. It's this guy that every time he turns his head has to move his entire body from all the hard work. And but all this is sort of just general sense of wonderment that I remember in my grandmother's eyes when she would look at new things. It's like, how are these things possible? Mm. But this sort of awe and childlike wonder at the world, which I found very special.
And the part of the story also deals with just how to know when your time has passed. Mm. And you and I are about the same age, and it's something I grapple with a lot, like wanting to be sure that like I sort of still have something to contribute in a sense. And do you worry about that for yourself? I mean, in a way, it comes back to where we started this conversation, and that like there are people who would tell you that like movies are on the way out.
Yeah. I mean, you know, relevance is a weird thing. I always saw myself as the youngest person in the room. You know, I was young when I started school. I was in that, you know, I started very young. I was young at drama school. I was always young, and now I'm not. I'm starting to become aware of it. The beauty of being an actor, if we're allowed to keep doing what we're doing, if AI doesn't, you know, mess everything up, is as long as my brain keeps working, I can keep learning about the new versions of myself as I get older. You know, Train Dreams was a good chance for me to see myself sort of in the middle of my life. Mm. But I wonder about relevance. I wonder about, like my character staring at a chainsaw in the movie and wondering how it's going to affect his world. I wonder that for myself as I still haven't, my phone's over there, I've never downloaded Chat GPT. I'm sort of terrified, but I also feel like I need to not turn a blind eye to it. I have young kids, I've got to accept this thing. But I do worry about what's it going to do to movies. When I feel optimistic about things, I always incite or evoke, Jonathan Glazer's film, Zone of Interest, because I think the genius of that film is the beautiful human thought behind the point of view of setting a Holocaust film in the general's house over the wall in an opulent setting. And I keep thinking, I don't think AI is going to come up with an idea like that, like think outside the box. And by all that, I mean, when I feel optimistic about the future of storytelling, I think it pushes us into more of a challenge of the unique thought, the unique piece of art, doing things that are bespoke. And I don't think we'll ever want to stop watching human beings or listen to human stories told by humans, starring humans, music made by humans, paintings painted by humans. I hope, yes, we can enjoy the wildness of what computers create for us. But I don't think zeros and ones are going to entirely ruin our lives. But then I can be pessimistic too, which I won't rant on about.
we'll keep it. We'll end on that optimistic note.
Yeah.
Joel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
All right, make sure you join us next month after Oscar nominations, where we'll have 3 new episodes of The Envelope. We will see you then.